We begin a new series today. This is called 12 Rules for Life. There's a book by this title that was done a few years ago by Jordan Peterson. And what happened is there's a website called Quora. Maybe you've run into that. And on Quora, you can ask any question you want. And anybody who wants to can answer the question. And then people go online and they upvote, give thumbs up for the answer that they like the best. And so Jordan Peterson was fooling around on Quora, which was sort of a hobby. He's a clinical psychologist and a university professor in Toronto. And he was on Quora, and somebody asked the question, what are the most valuable things that you should know about life? And so he thought, well, that's an interesting one I'd like to chime in on. And part of his answers were silly, you know, just being kind of funny and tongue-in-cheek. But some of them were solemn, very important. And he ended up with 42 things in his list that people should know, the most valuable things that people should know. Well, they began to upvote him, and pretty soon it went viral, and thousands, hundreds of thousands of people were reading his list. So a literary critic or a literary agent called on the phone and asked Jordan Peterson if he would like to turn that list into a for real book that could be published. And he said, yes, he would like to do that. Well, you can't have a book with 42 chapters. So he brought it down to 25 things, the most valuable things that every person should know about life. And you can't have a book with 25 chapters. So he got it down to 16 and then eventually 12. And that's what the book was. It became a bestseller and is an excellent book. And we actually spent some time looking at it here in our Sunday school class. But then I'm reading all of this and the thought occurs to me, what if my children and maybe more probably my grandchildren asked me, you know, what are the 12 most important valuable things you can learn in life? And I thought, you know, my mind is spinning like, I don't know what the 12 are. And I should. I'm now entering the last one third of my life expectancy. And so I've been two thirds done. I ought to know the answer to this. And what if, you know, something were to happen and I were to die? How would little Silas or Reagan have any idea who I was and what I was all about if they said, well, I don't really know what my papa was all about? And even my own sons, I want them to know, what are the 12 most valuable things that you should know about life? And so I decided that I would do this. And I did it for my kids and grandkids. And then as I was doing it, I thought, well, that's dumb. I should just do this for a sermon series, too. And so here we are. And rule number one is you have to realize, you have to live according to this rule, that only the Christian faith can solve what you're looking for in life for happiness. It can't be found anywhere else. And not just conversion. We mean happiness all through life. And then when you die, all through eternity. So rule number one, embrace this, that Christianity, the Christian faith, is your only hope for happiness, lasting happiness in this world and the next. It is your only hope. And then, of course, you have to prove that. And so we prove it by starting where we have to start, with creation. If you don't believe that there is a God in the first place, if you don't believe that there is a creator God in the first place, then you have no real hope. And this is my most earnest and sincere premise. You have no real hope for happiness in this world or the next. Not lasting happiness. I mean, we can all get happiness if we go to Disney World for a day. That's kind of fun. You know, it's the happiest place on earth. So we can all get fleeting happiness. But it's not the same. If you want lasting happiness in this life and in the next, Christianity, the Christian faith, is literally your only hope. All right, so how do we even know that that's true? We start with the Creator God. It's like this, Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God. That's where it all begins. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. All right, well, let's say you don't believe that. Say I go to the university and the professor tells me something different. He says that God didn't create it and it's all here by random chance. All right, well, let's try it. If I were to tell you that a tornado blowing through a junkyard could assemble a fully functional 747 jet airplane, would you believe me? I think you would not. You would say that 1 million tornadoes blowing through 1 million junkyards wouldn't assemble anything that looks like a jet airplane that fully works. You just don't believe that. And if I said, no, you don't understand. I mean, they're like way more than 1 million tornadoes blowing through way more. I mean, let's say billions. Then would you believe it? You would say, no, you don't understand. That's not how tornadoes work. That's not how 747s come together. It wouldn't matter how many times you did it. Actually, if you had a complete 747 sitting there that does work, and a tornado blew through it, it would make it worse, not better. It's never going to make it better. A tornado can't make it better. And it didn't matter how many times the tornado blew through the junkyard, it will never, ever, ever work, because that's not how tornadoes work. So you're in the university and they say, well, you silly Christians believe that there is a creator. And it's the same as saying, young man, young lady, how can I possibly respect your intelligence if you don't even believe that 747s are assembled by tornadoes? You think, oh, wow, that really hurts my feelings. He won't respect my intelligence. But you have to stick to it here. You know what? 747 airplanes don't just big bang into existence. And neither do watches. Watches don't big bang into existence. And neither do universes. That's just not how things come together. Big bangs cause things to come apart. So we know there has to be a creator. And a tornado will never assemble a 747. That's not how tornadoes work. We need God to do that. All right, so if we accept the premise now that there is a creator God, then the next question is, well, how do we know which religion in the world, if any religion in the world, best explains this creator God? Because there are competing religions. So why should we land on Christianity? And there are two answers for that. The first answer is the history of the resurrection. And the second answer, we'll come to in a minute, but the resurrection is the key to the whole thing. The biggest problem you have in your life, for sure, is death. And until you find a religion that answers that question, and of course every religion answers the question, but until you find a religion that answers that question with hard data, you can't trust that religion. That's what Christianity does. What you need is a religion that solves the biggest problem you'll ever have, death. And that does it in such a way that there is history, historical data to show it. And that's what we have with the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus actually died and he came back from death. And whoever comes back from death wins. If you've conquered death, you have the right, you have the street credibility to come back and tell me what it's like to die and how to solve this problem. But if you haven't conquered death, you have no say in my mind. I want to talk to the guy who's actually done it. And that's what Jesus did. So you say, how do we know that Jesus did that? And the answer is in 1 Corinthians 15. This is the longest chapter in the Bible on the subject of the resurrection of Jesus. A lot of times people try to late date the Gospels because the idea is to get it as far removed from eyewitness evidence as possible. So we want all the Gospels to come late, 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 where there's all this embellishment and improving on the story. And then we'll say, see, the resurrection is just a campfire story that a bunch of old guys concocted when they were sitting around one evening with nothing to do. But that doesn't work too well for 1 Corinthians 15. If you went to talk to a diehard atheist, I mean somebody who hates the Bible, and you were to say, what date shall we put on 1 Corinthians 15? When was it written? It doesn't matter. All over the world, wherever you go, the most diehard atheists are going to say, well, I will grant you that 1 Corinthians 15 was written in about 55 A.D. All right, so if it's 55 A.D. and everyone's going to agree on that, the good guys, the bad guys, they all agree on that. And 1 Corinthians 15 is all about the resurrection of Jesus. The question is, what does 55 A.D. mean to if 1 Corinthians was written in 55 A.D., so what? Okay, well, that means that we're within 25 years of Jesus' death and resurrection when 1 Corinthians 15 was written. And everybody agrees. They're not going to say, oh, yeah, that was written 100 years after the fact and nobody knows what was going on. No, it's 25 years. And once you all agree on 25 years or less, now you have eyewitness evidence. Not only that, but in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, I delivered unto you first that which also I have received. That was a Jewish rabbinical way of saying, I didn't make this up. And of course, that was true of Paul, because he hated the Christian doctrine of resurrection, and that's why he supervised the killing of Stephen. So you remember, Stephen was the first Christian martyr. And this is very soon after the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus that Stephen was killed, probably within months of Jesus' passion. And Paul is there supervising that. So in 55 AD, he says, I was told this. I didn't make this up. I was told this by others. And indeed, he was. He had been aware of the resurrection for years by the time 1 Corinthians 15 is written. So that means we are solidly within the realm of eyewitness evidence. And that's so important, because if you want to establish anything in life, if you're a detective, and you want to find out if a certain crime happened in a certain place, here's what you have to do. You have to figure out the time and the place, and then you can find the who. And so a detective will come along, and he'll ask, was it Colonel Mustard in the library? And once you have the place, was it in the library? And was Colonel Mustard there? Because there weren't a lot of other people there, right? That's how you establish truth in history. That's what we do. We go to Jerusalem. Not a big place. That doesn't work. We have to do it this way. Well, it doesn't work. Mark Twain says, because he visited Jerusalem shortly after the Civil War. And when he came back, he said, I don't know how else to describe this to you. Jerusalem is the nobbiest, because it has lots of hills. It's the nobbiest little town you'll ever see. So if you're going to go to eyewitness evidence in this knobby little town and say, well, looky here, did anything extraordinary happen here a few years back with the tomb of a VIP named Joseph of Arimathea, and there was a lot of commotion about somebody rising from death? Did that happen in this little place called Jerusalem? Within 25 years, people say, yeah, I know all about it. Eyewitness evidence. The old joke that was told by Richard Pryor when he's doing his stand-up comedian shows, he would, you know, spin some wild, ridiculous yarn, and then with big eyes and great conviction, he would look at his wife, who he's lying to, and say, so are you going to believe me or your lying eyes? And that's what it comes to. You have eyewitness evidence. Was there commotion around this tomb? It came up empty. It was guarded and nobody understands why. Did it happen or did it not happen? And the only way you could deny that it happened is to say, I'm lying. You know, you got to just trust me. I'm sure it's not what you think it is. It happened. And that's why the resurrection doctrine caught on in the very time eyewitnesses established and place. A little knobby town, and you can't get away from it. That's the data. So we know that there has to be a God. We know that the religion in the world that best explains who that God is the Christian religion, and we can take that to the bank because we have eyewitness evidence of a resurrection. And there's nothing really else like that in the world of religion. All right, so then you think, okay, so then, how is Christianity the only solution to lasting happiness in this world and the next? How is that possible? And the answer is going to come down to awe. We spoke about awe in our previous series on prayer because it really does come to bear on this. There is a tremendous sense of awe in the gospel of Jesus Christ, and it's not just on the day of our conversion, but all through our lives. And this is what makes life wonderful. You realize that in Scripture, there's this idea of the fear of the Lord keeps coming up, and you don't like that. I know you don't like that because I live in the same generation you do, and when I see fear of the Lord, I flinch. When I'm preaching about the fear of the Lord, I flinch. Some of my colleagues flinch more than I do. They'll say, well, you shouldn't use the word fear. You should use the word reverence or respect. And that's okay. But you should know that sometimes in the Bible, the word fear is coupled with trembling. So when Moses was at Mount Sinai, it says, and so frightening was the sight that Moses said, I exceedingly fear and quake. Well, you know what? You don't quake. You don't tremble because you respect somebody. You tremble when you fear them. And you think, well, does God really want us to fear him? And there's a sense in which the answer is yes. And not only that, in your heart of hearts, you know that that's true. Because you like to be afraid. I know you like to be afraid because sometimes you talk about such things as bungee jumping and skydiving and whatever is your hobby that is a little bit scary. You like that. And if you don't have any scary hobbies, you still watch movies that are kind of scary. Like what did you think was going to happen at Jurassic Park? They were going to kiss the dinosaurs on the lips. You watch that because you like to be a little bit scared as long as it's controlled. And that's why you like to go to the Grand Canyon and look over the edge. It's scary, but you like it. And you would not like to go to the Grand Canyon and stay way back where you can't really see very well. You want to get close. You want to go to the Niagara Falls, and you know they don't put the sidewalks way back there. They put the sidewalks right on the edge. And then they put a little bump out, so if you're really crazy, you can go out there and you're over the water because you like to be a little bit afraid. That's what it is, the sense of awe. It's awesome, a word we overuse, right? We say our pancakes are awesome, or our shoelaces that we just got. These are awesome shoelaces. Well, you can do that if you want. You know, we're not going to bicker over the language. But some things are really, really awesome in this world, and it's not pancakes and shoelaces. The things that make you afraid, it's that wonderful, perfect storm, emotional storm of fear, like I'm standing next to Niagara Falls, and the rocks I'm standing on are shaking. And I like it. That is awesome. So it's a little bit scary, but it's also fascinating, and it's wonderful, and I want to do it again. That's what we're talking about, the awesomeness of the Lord. And Mike Massimino was the guy who did the spacewalk to repair the Hubble telescope. So the Hubble telescope, 350 miles above the Earth. The International Space Station is only 250 miles. So he went 100 miles past the International Space Station, and he had to do a spacewalk. He finished the spacewalk, and he's waiting on his partner, to be done. And somebody said, listen, Mike, you have 15 minutes before Bueno's ready to get back inside the spacecraft. So why don't you just go out on your tether line and hang out? And he did. And he said, from there, 350 miles up, you see the entire Earth, the curvature of the Earth. And he said to look back on Earth was the most beautiful thing. If you can imagine, like the moon looks as old as a dusty old bone. You know, there's like no color. And all of space, you look around, no color, no color, no color. And then there's Earth and, you know, the beautiful blue and white marble. And he said he got so emotional looking back at Earth that he wanted to cry, but he had to hold back his tears because he didn't want moisture to get in his spacesuit. And he said, it was the most beautiful thing. He said, this must be what heaven is like. Like, this is a paradise. And he said, and if you were a believer, the thought you would have is, whoever created this must love us very much because he definitely gave us the nicest house on the block. And it's awe. Like, do you like to be? And he said, you know, they're constantly monitoring his pulse when he's up there. And they said when he was out there doing a spacewalk for a little time there, his pulse rate shot up because it's scary and it's wonderful. And it's like a religious experience. And every time there's awe in your life, that is like a religious experience. Because awe is what God is. So you feel awe sometimes when you're looking at the Grand Canyon, Niagara Falls, a beautiful starry night. When you're rocking your baby, you sense awe. When you're in love, there's this cute song that was done by a pop singer in Canada. It's called Once in Every Life. And one of the stanzas says, once in every life, love should make you feel so good you cry. And it's awe, the sense of awe, like life is so good. I am so excited. Life is awesome. Matter of fact, you know, some awe. What it really is, life is awful. It's full of awe and being in love. And that's why you tell a 14-year-old girl, hey, you have to break up with that boyfriend. He's no good. And she says, oh, he's wonderful. She's having like a religious experience. It's awe. But problem is, it goes away. It's fleeting. And if you want lasting happiness, you have to find lasting awe, and that is only going to be possible in the religion of Jesus Christ. It's going to be possible when you worship together. There are times when we're all worshiping together, and the thought occurs to me as we're worshiping, this is it. This is awe. I love being here. I love singing about the Lord. The superficial things are all falling away. And you know, you have a constant parade of celebrities checking themselves in to rehab facilities and suicide prevention programs because they've lost their sense of awe. When you are no more awed by life, you can't find a lot of reason left to live. And only the Christian faith is going to give you a sense of awe when you're with the Lord. I'm just going to remind you how this comes, and it comes in so many different ways. There's a sense of awe that comes to you when you're in prayer. Remember in Acts chapter 16, Paul and Silas are singing and praising the Lord, and it's at that time that the earthquake comes and loosens their bonds and they're free. That's an awesome experience. And there are times when we are praying and we're going to have awesome experiences. You will know that you're in the presence of God. And when that happens, that is extraordinary. You realize how often this happens? When you are having a certain time of reading the Bible, sometimes things happen to you. There is a sense of awe that settles over you. In Luke 24, the disciples are walking on the road to Emmaus, and the resurrected Jesus joins them, and they don't realize who he is. And at some point, Jesus begins to tell them all of the ways that the Old Testament prophets were being fulfilled by the life of their Messiah, including the death of Messiah. And then they recognize Jesus, and he departs from them, and they say one to another, didn't our hearts burn within us? Well, he spoke with us by the way, by the road, and opened to us the scriptures. Did you feel it? Didn't your heart burn when he was talking about these things? Remember Bilki Sheikh? I spoke about her a couple weeks ago. Muslim lady in Pakistan, lonely in her Islamic religion. And the thought occurred to her that she should get a Bible. She asked one of her servants to please bring her a Bible, but he was afraid to do it because, you know, you get in big trouble for towing around a Bible in Pakistan. But he found one and secretly snuck it into the house where nobody would see. And she got up one day and there it was in the living room, a Bible. And she had never opened the Bible. And so she went over to it and she just opened it up to wherever. And she happened upon Romans chapter 9. I will call them my people, which were not my people, and her beloved, which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass in the place where it was said to them, you are not the people of God, there shall they be called the children of God. It actually struck her like a bolt of lightning. She caught her breath and she said, what is it that just happened when I saw the Christian Bible? That's awe. It just happens. It happens when you pray. It happens when you read the Bible. Didn't our hearts burn within us? Wasn't Wasn't there some kind of electricity happening there? Wasn't there some sort of magic happening there? And it does. And it happens with the providence of God. Remember, Jesus tells the disciples before his triumphal entry, you'll go into the village across the way. You're going to find a little colt tied up that no person has ever ridden. And I want you to untie him and bring him to me. And if somebody says, what are you doing? Tell them the master has need of him and they'll let you come. That's exactly what happened. That's providence, the awe of providence, the awe of prayer, the awe of Bible reading, the awe of providence. That's exactly what happened. That's crazy. But that's what the Lord is doing. So, 9-year-old boy is at his grandparents' house. They have a swimming pool. His name is Thad. Thad is a skinny 9-year-old kid. It's a coolish morning, not very good for swimming. And all of a sudden, he gets it in his mind, I want to go swimming, Mom. And she is reluctant. I was like, well, I guess if the kid wants to go swimming, you know, he's not going to take no for an answer. So for whatever reason, Thad is all about swimming that morning. And he isn't usually about swimming, but, you know, he's just got to be in his bonnet and he's going to go swimming. He hurries, he peels off his clothes, puts on his swim shorts, goes running to the pool, and he dives in the shallow end. And when he comes up swimming underwater, he sees his little 3-year-old sister sitting in the bottom of the pool. Well, he brings her to the surface. He screams for help. Everybody comes running out of the house. Mom grabs the little girl, and she starts giving her mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And sure enough, she is resuscitated. The doctor said she had been underwater for 1 minute, maybe 2 minutes, and she was very, very close to dying. Query, what made that little boy uncharacteristically say, I'm not taking no for an answer. I'm going to go swimming and I'm going to go now. That's the providence of God. You're going to find a little donkey tied up. And if somebody says, what are you doing? Say, well, the master wants me to do it. It's just crazy that the sense of awe settled over the whole family. Like, what just happened here? God was at work. You can have fleeting awe from a romance or for, you know, looking at nature, Niagara Falls, whatever. But if you want lasting and frequent awe, you're going to have to find it in the Christian faith. And it's no good if you find it in false religion. Like if somebody deceives you, the Wizard of Oz, you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. If somebody deceives you, then eventually you find out that there is no Wizard of Oz. It's just a fake. And then you have disappointment. So you can have awe that's not lasting, it's not legitimate, or you can have awe in God the Creator, God the resurrected Messiah, and you will never be disappointed. It's lasting, not fleeting, and it's frequent, not just once in your life, but all the time, again and again and again, these constant infusions of the presence of God. You just don't know how often this comes up. Helen Rosevere, in the 1960s in Africa, she's setting up a medical mission. There is a rebellion in Africa. It's called the Simba Rebellion in Congo, where she lives. They grab her. She is the founder of the hospital there in Ibobango. And they grab her and they take her hostage. I mean, it's a horrible story that I'm not even going to tell you the details of. But it involves all the bad things that happen when women are abducted. They were very, very cruel to her. Horrible. And she said when they took her back to the compound, she didn't know what to pray. She said, if any prayer came to my mind, it was the prayer of Jesus when he said, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's the prayer that came to mind, but she didn't want to pray that. And she said, just at that time, like in this white-hot crisis moment, suddenly, there was just the presence of God. She said, it was indescribable. It was fantastic. It was as if the Lord put his arms around me in that situation and said, you know, I will never leave you or forsake you. You have to do this for me, but I will never leave you. And she said, all of a sudden, there was just a joy, a peace. Everything was going to be okay. Harlan Popov, arrested in Bulgaria for the Christian faith in the communist days. They brought him in this horrible room. It was isolation, no light of any kind. And he'd been there for weeks. And you kind of feel like, oh, no, you know, I'm never going to get out of here. There was some chance that that would be exactly what happened. And in his despair, he said, a sense of light came into that solitary cell. And it was like the Lord wrapped his arms around him. He said, I know the readers of my story aren't going to believe this. But it was like God was there, and it was the same message. I will never leave you or forsake you. And in that situation, as bad as it was, there was awe. The feeling that Mike Massimino felt when he looked back on Earth from space happened in a solitary, pitch-dark prison cell. That's the awe of God. Darlene Rose, World War II era, her husband is carted off by the Japanese invaders. They are in Indonesia. Japan took over Indonesia, took her husband to the prison camps. Short time later, she's in the prison camp. She goes into her prison cell, and over her cell is a sign that says, this person is worthy of death. And so she's in it, and she collapses to the ground, and she thinks, I have been absolutely forsaken. I gave up my life to be a missionary in Indonesia, and now I'm a World War II POW in a Japanese camp, and the sign on the door says, this is death row. And she just felt despair. And then she said, and this little song came to my mind that she sang all the time in her Sunday school class. It's Only Believe. And the opening line is, fear not, little flock. Only believe, only believe. And she says, I know it sounds impossible, but it was like the Lord wrapped his arms around me and told me, Darlene, I will never leave you or forsake you. Awe, as if you were in space looking at Earth or on vacation at the Grand Canyon or Niagara Falls, that happening in a Japanese prison camp. That's just impossible. But that's why this religion is what you need. Darlene Rose says, I know I keep telling everybody wherever I go that the Lord spoke to me. And somebody says, well, how do you know it was the Lord that spoke to you? She said, well, here's the best illustration I can think of. After all those years in the prison camp, I was finally released. I went to the first place I could where I could call my family back home. And so she was so emotional, she couldn't hardly even talk. And also, the way payphones worked had changed. She didn't know how to do it, so somebody else had to come and help her make the connection to her family home. And the operator made the connection. Operator said, we have Darlene Rose on the line. We accept the call. And they did. And Darlene Rose says, I heard my mother pick up. I heard the line pick up. And she said, hello, Darlene. She said, I hadn't heard my mother say one word for 8 years. And when she said, hello, Darlene, I knew absolutely for sure it was my mother. Nobody says, hello, Darlene, like that. People say, how do you know that the Lord spoke to you? I just know. She said, in all of this, there had been so much awe that she just loved the Lord. And she has recently died. But to the end of her life, when she was talking to audiences, she often said this, I don't even count the sacrifice anymore. Every night in bed, before I go to sleep, I say, Lord Jesus, I still love you, and I'll go anywhere for you. So I hope you remember rule number one. The only chance you have in this universe for lasting happiness is the Christian faith.